Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to Primetime's Thrones Recap Podcast with Andrew Nemec and Mike Lynch. Every week after each Game of Thrones episode, we'll give you a deep dive into the action in Westeros and beyond and predictions on what's to come. Thanks for listening. Fresh off a mini vacation in which he suckled at the teat of a widow giant and ready to talk season 8, episode 2, A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms. It's Mikey Lynch. What up, my guy?
So you're calling me Tormund, and I got called the Mountain by my cousin's boyfriend at Passover this weekend. So I am now a dead blue guy who's really big, and I'm a giant's bane milk suckling guy who loves Brienne. Who am I? What is happening?
You just look giant's breast milk refreshed. That's what I would say. You look like a man who's been sucking at the teat of a giant and is ready to rock after a vacation. You went to a Yankee game.
I did go to a Yankee game and got some great seats. It was a walk-off win, so it was a good game. And got to watch Game of Thrones the next morning after it happened. Watched the Blazers game on Sunday night. So it was a good little mix of watching things I wanted to do and family time and going to Yankee games, good food. Yeah. So, and the Game of Thrones episode was great. Absolutely fantastic.
Opening scene, Jaime standing in front of Daenerys and the entire North, basically, explaining that Cersei is not coming. And Dany starts out giving him the speech about, I've dreamed of this moment, being in front of the man who killed my father. And she doesn't react right away, which I think is a good thing. Nobody just jumped up and murdered him. They let him speak. I thought that was a really interesting scene. And at the same time, of all the scenes we've seen where they're built up with what could possibly happen, it seemed even before Lady Brienne of Tarth, soon to be Sir Brienne of Tarth, speaks up for him, I didn't think they were going to kill him.
No. I didn't think so either. It didn't feel right at the time. And I think that scene proves again that Daenerys will be different than her father in ruling because she listens to her counsel. She wanted to kill Jaime. And I don't think she even had a doubt about killing Jaime. But Sansa spoke up first. Then John, who was being weird because he found out he was sleeping with his aunt and hadn't told her yet, was just like, whatever, you just do whatever you want. And then Brienne came in and kind of saved the day for Jaime. It kind of just showed that she's willing to listen to her counsel, and that'll maybe come into play after how this episode wrapped up, which we'll talk about in a second. But it'll be very interesting to see if she continues to listen to her counsel as the battles get more and more intense.
We also got another creepy touch of Bran when Jaime says, you know, all the things I've done that were terrible, we were doing because we were fighting one another, we were at war, and Bran drops the line, the things we do for love, which is, of course, what Jaime says to him as he pushes him off the ledge.
In episode one, season one, episode one,
right.
That's what he says. The things I do for love, pushes him out the window. Yeah.
It was a great line.
I am all on board Bran bringing back lines of the past to F with people on this show. It is so funny to see their reactions when he says stuff like that, and they're like, how do you know that? And then in the next scene, Bran is by himself in the Godswood. How is he getting these places? Hodor is not pushing him anymore. What's happening?
There has to be an official wheelchair pusher person who also knows quite a lot.
Yes.
Because he's following Bran around, and Bran is dropping these nuggets of gold about what's going to happen in the battle, or potentially what's happened with different characters throughout. He's giving all these lectures to all these very important characters. And if you were just a side villager, and suddenly this crippled boy is like lecturing the queen and lecturing Jon and talking to Jaime, you'd be like, man, I've seen some real serious famous people here, and this little boy is belittling them at every turn, and they just look shocked every time he says these random lines, like the things we do for love,
right?
And then Jaime's
chaos
face
is a ladder.
What keeps happening here? You held a knife to his throat. What
are they like hiding? Are they, so does the villager push Bran into the godswood and then hide behind the tree and it's just like, I'll be over here.
He hides in a closet. He has to stand in a closet. After he pushes him somewhere, he goes and waits in a closet and then gets out
just,
and comes in.
No matter where, he's also carrying a closet with him. He just goes, there's like a random like cupboard in the corner of the woods and you're like, what is this? And the villager comes out. I'm just waiting for Bran to be done to go somewhere else. Okay, bye. I can't hear you. Don't worry.
Then we've got Daenerys, and we talked about this last week, belittling Tyrion for his missteps, and that was one of the reasons that he signaled being a loser of the week last week in episode one. Is she says, again, you were tricked by your family. You thought Casterly Rock would be this valuable piece in this battle. They just completely abandoned it, and because of that, we lost the Iron Fleet. We lost a battle because of you, and now here we thought we were getting help in the north. And Cersei was lying to you, and you fell for it. And I think it is the first time maybe that Tyrion really does feel completely vulnerable, where he doesn't know what to expect. I know there are other times where he's taken shots, but I don't think he's ever felt like, I am just an absolute fool. Uh-oh, is my sister smarter than me at this point because she is more ruthless and I am kinder maybe? And I think that's me interpreting the character, but you know, kind of being like, because I have sentiment and she has none, I'm getting duped here.
I think that's a great point. It's the first time he feels like he cannot get out of the situation using his wits. When he was previously the Hand of the King earlier in this series, I should say, he was basically ruling for Joffrey because Joffrey didn't want to do anything and couldn't do anything, right? So he got to rule. And all the decisions he made were in a world that he understood, in a political world that he understood, with deceit and backstabbing and politics. And now he's the Hand to Daenerys, who is not an idiot and is making her own decisions, but going to him for advice. And they're no longer in a world of deceit. They're in a world of life or death. And he is now twice messed up. And, well, I guess technically three times messed up, because he didn't expect the Euron's army to attack him when they were going to King's Landing. He didn't expect them to give up on Castle Rock, and he expected Cersei to follow with some army. So he's just been wrong, and he's got nothing more but basically one more shot to prove his worth to Daenerys, at least until Jorah goes and talks to her, where she goes, I will give that sigil to somebody else. I'll give the little upside-down hand thing on your lapel to somebody else. If you cannot give me good advice, I trusted you, and you are getting outwitted. I don't know what the right word would be, but you're losing.
You're being outwitted.
Yeah, you're losing.
And we skip a scene here. We're skipping a scene here because it does tie in. Tyrion's so rocked by the fact that he is getting just dominated here mentally by Cersei. Meets with Jaime, and that has to be humbling, because he's always thought Jaime was the good fighter and the handsome blonde one, but in reality didn't have enough between the ears to be as smart as him. And in that way, he felt superior to him. And then here you have this scene, and he said, was she lying? Was she lying about the baby too? And of course he knows Jaime would know, because he knows that they're in a relationship. Yep. But Tyrion's so rocked by it, he wants to know, is there even really a baby? And that goes to show how much he's thought about it, because she does hold her stomach. She refuses to drink the wine. And so now he's so in his feelings, he's now thinking about her body language in their conversation and saying, oh man, did she trick me even with her body language? And I think that goes to show just how torn up Tyrion is about that situation.
I guess it's still possible that she is faking about the baby, right? Because she told Jaime it was his, and then she showed Tyrion with the body language, but we have no proof.
And
right?
Not drinking wine, which right. For her is a big deal. Right. She starts a good 9 a.m., 10 a.m. start to the day with some wine.
And she goes about 19 jugs deep, which only beaten by Tyrion. But we don't know for sure, right? She could be faking this whole thing just to connive and get more power and get more control. It's something that she's always done.
When you said 19 jugs deep, only surpassed by Tyrion, I thought you were making a boob joke about him constantly sleeping with hookers.
It's been a while since he has.
And yeah, it has been. I mean, he's really dealing with a lot as the Hand. He is not getting laid nearly as much
well,
as
actually,
he used to.
In this episode, he mentioned it. He goes, since I got betrayed by Shay, he didn't say so many words, but that's what he was implying, I haven't had the stomach to even do that.
Right.
So he hasn't done it since then, which is pretty crazy for him.
We get a really cool moment, and again, we keep seeing these scenes that go back to season one, episode one, and again, Arya, with the amazing accuracy, throws the knives and hits the bullseye just like in the very first, or her created bullseye. It's a post. She just keeps hitting the same spot. But in season one, episode one, Bran's trying to learn to shoot a bow and arrow. She shoots one and hits the bullseye. We keep having these little moments, particularly for Arya. Arya in the last episode, season eight, episode one, is in the crowd as the queen arrives instead of the king, like yep. she was for. So we keep having these moments for Arya that are very reminiscent of what she went through in season one. And she asks for the weapon she asked Gendry to make for her, and says, and it's a great line. Again, there's a number of good lines. I know death. And he sees her throw those knives and goes, I'll get right on making that weapon for you.
I think she says something like, I know death. Death has many faces and is different for everybody. Something like that.
Right.
And I think the callbacks to the first season for Arya is, it's almost necessary because of what happens later in this episode with Arya, where you need to realize just how much you've seen her grow up. I think she is the character that you have watched grow up the most in this show, right? Sansa has grown up, everybody's grown up, but you've watched Sansa grow up, but she's been put in so many bad situations that she's kind of just been fighting to survive. Whereas Arya has been put in so many situations where she was forced to adult when she was young, 12 years old or whatever it was, how she started in the show, when she escaped King's Landing and had to go up north to the Wall, and then you met with the Beric Dondarrion, and then the Hound is with you, and you go across the narrow sea to Braavos, and you're with the many-faced god. All of these things have changed who she is 100%, yet she still has some similarities. And I think it was very important in this episode, knowing what happens at the end of it, to realize just how much you've seen her change and mature into now a woman.
Well, look at the children we started with in season one, episode one, and what has happened with them.
Have you ever looked at the pictures of them?
All the Lannister kids are dead.
Yeah.
Rickon is dead.
Yep.
Bran, for all intent and purpose, is no longer Bran. He's the Three-Eyed Raven. He is gone. Rob tried to make the jump from really a young boy. I mean, he's a teenage boy, but a boy, and they in the very first scene, they're getting haircuts, talking about girls and all that, and tries to make the jump to king and does not survive that leap. John always feels like an outsider. He has no childness to him. There is no childlike quality about
Stannis's
him.
Daughter
even
is
from
dead.
The beginning, Stannis's daughter is dead. All of these characters, Sansa is so worried about being a lady from the very beginning. She's already started adulting when we start this show. The only child who has successfully really made the transition from childhood to adulthood, womanhood, or manhood,
Stoneface Killerhood,
without, not unscathed, because she certainly suffered, but who's actually been able to make that leap and remain a player on the board, has been Arya. All the other characters died, and it is interesting that they choose to continue to go back to her more childlike qualities, which made a scene later very awkward for me and for a lot of viewers.
All of us, yes.
I'm sure. I think everyone had a hard time.
It was like a mix of celebration and awkwardness all at the same time. Now, don't forget, we did skip one. Jorah goes to Daenerys and says, trust Tyrion. Because Daenerys is about to throw Tyrion out to the wolves, essentially. And Jorah,
no pun intended.
Right. And Jorah goes to her and says, he is incredibly smart. Sure, he's made some mistakes. I've made some mistakes. True. He probably made the worst mistake of all of her most trusted advisors by giving away her secrets when she was younger. And she has accepted him back into her life. And she... I did not expect Jorah to do that after their journey to when he captured Tyrion, and that's when he got Grayscale for the first time. He really didn't like Tyrion on that whole journey, but at the end, he and Tyrion had to get out of slavery together. And because of that, he trusted his wits and he trusts his brain and his ability to lead. And he goes to her and says, look, take it for what it's worth, but let me tell you that you should not give up on this guy so easily. So that, I thought that was a really important scene.
It was an important scene. And then we have Daenerys and Sansa, their meeting, and obviously you get that they don't like each other particularly. Again, there's that, like, we're both hot girls that don't know each other, so we have to immediately not like each other. Not real sure where that comes from, but they kind of seemingly come to an understanding. And of course, Sansa, being as savvy as she is now, being as untrusting as she is, still drops that the North does not like to be controlled, and that could potentially, I'm sure you're supposed to put a pin in that. That could potentially be a sticking point down the road, .. if they all survive.
Right. Well, that was the thing, is that it was going swimmingly, but it also felt very shallow. In the beginning, it was like the pleasantries, the, oh, hey, hi, I'm going to be here and I'm going to make things better. And then Sansa, who you thought was almost, I don't want to say being tricked, but being goaded into just being accepting of Daenerys in this conversation, we know better as viewers because we've seen Sansa mature into a leader. She throws the hammer down and says, well, what about us? When we separated from the Iron Throne, we said we will never be ruled by the Iron Throne again. What about the North? And Daenerys gives her that look and then moves her hand off of her hand,
which was
a very symbolic gesture, which I think we've seen all of us guys. And if you're a girl out there listening too, you've probably dealt with this before in the like fake conversation where you're trying to make nice and then all of a sudden something happens and that one thing you were doing that you didn't want to do but you did for the appearance of it, you stop. That's what Daenerys did by moving the hand off. She was like, yeah, I don't know about that yet because I'm supposed to be the leader of the Seven Kingdoms, not the Six, and the North is by itself.
Right. Then we have Theon coming back and a really heartfelt hug between he and Sansa.
The beginning of the tears for all us viewers.
Right, and he says he'd like to fight for the North. And I think poor Theon, then Reek, now back to Theon, has been through so much and deservedly so for some of his missteps early on. This is a full circle for him, and he agrees to kind of be the bait, I guess, and go to the Godswood with Sansa, right?
Just with Bran. He and the Ironborn are going to go protect Bran in the Godswood.
You're right. That's right. So they're going to go protect Bran and be a key part of this battle. And you know, if you go back and think about all the things Theon's done, it took him a lot to earn back that level of trust from the Starks. I don't foresee that being a massive misstep. I think he's in it. You know, he could have gone Greyjoy, he could have gone Stark, and at the very end, he decides, you know, I'm going to live and die as a Stark. And I think that's interesting. I think it's an interesting circle for him to go through as a character.
It is. I've never been a huge fan of the Greyjoy story in the show. I think they're way more interesting in the books. But that moment, I did not know how Sansa would react, right? Now, obviously, he saved her life. He led her out of Winterfell when she was with Ramsay, and they jumped off into the snow, and they ran, and then Theon saved her when they got caught near the tree. He was there to protect her. But it was a very strange thought of mine for what would Sansa do when she saw Theon again, because for those few positive things he did, he was also Reek for a majority of the time. He went to Ramsay and foiled her original plan to help her. Ramsay made him watch him rape her, right? It was a really, really strange relationship between those two. Oh, yeah, and he betrayed the North and pretended to kill both of her brothers.
Yeah.
So I wasn't really sure how she was going to react. And although I thought it was really heartfelt, part of me was going, this seems too genuine for someone who's done so much bad and one good thing. Granted, it was saving her life. But did the one good thing to help get her out of there. It was very nice, and I got really emotional during it because it was, you know, you're tied into these characters. But I was also a little surprised she reacted so genuinely.
And it's a good point. And I think of all the characters, one of the things that sticks out to me too as being odd is Sansa's been through a lot with a lot of different characters. It is somewhat odd that out of all the characters, the person that she seems to outwardly show any affection to is Theon, who, again, as you pointed out, watched her get raped, foiled a plan for her escape the first time. And yes, he did help her escape, but
And he saved her because he killed, I don't remember the character's name,
the girlfriend of...
Right, of Ramsay. He just threw her off the edge.
Yeah, yes, but does that really... Is that really more meaningful than growing up with Arya and Jon? And the answer for Sansa clearly is yes. She's not very trusting of Jon. She trusts Arya, but there's a coldness to them that's always been there. With Theon, they're close. And it is somewhat odd that the things that she's been through, out of all the things she's been through, the only person that she really seems to have an emotional, I forget my hardened Cersei-like self now, is Theon.
Yeah, it's very, very strange. And that's why I had that thought of how is she going to react to this? And I get it in some ways. you know, you have a life and death experience with someone, or close to death experience with someone, I should say. You get very, very close. You always see that in real life where, you know, you people just bond because of the pressure of a situation.
Right.
But maybe also because literally everyone in her life was negative around her, and finally someone was positive and helped her, and that was Theon.
Right.
Because even Littlefinger,
that's a good point.
Even though Littlefinger was helping her, he was also manipulating her into doing things he wanted. Where I would say
she felt like she was allyless probably for years of
her
life, and he was the first one who offered her a glimmer of hope.
Yep.
I think you're right. I think that probably is that. Missandei and Grey Worm potentially say goodbye to each other. They make plans to retire together on the beach.
In Narth, I think that's where she's from.
It just doesn't. And then she says, you know, my people aren't a fighting people. And he says, well, my people are. We will protect you. It's really touching. It just seems very unlikely to happen. It was the only farewell I saw where I went, no way. It was the only one where I thought there's no way they both live. There's no way.
Well, in an episode that was filled with potential farewells for us, the viewer, that was the most obvious good one moment to me.
Right.
When they had the heartfelt moment and I was like, Grey Worm's dying.
Right.
And hell, Missandei might even die. And this is that moment where you say goodbye to those characters who I think a lot of the viewers like, but their storyline wasn't as fleshed out as some of the other ones that they did. So it was a very brief moment, and it was just one of those things. I know my wife loves Grey Worm and Missandei. She loves that combination, but it was one of those. She even said it to me when we were watching. She goes, yeah, that's not going to happen.
Right, right.
They're dead.
It was the most obvious they're not making it.
Yeah.
And again, it speaks to your point. Missandei talking about her, you know, where she grew up and saying, this is where I'm from. It's one of the first times we get a reference to where she's from, not necessarily in the books, but in the show. They are kind of yada yada over. And we know that Grey Worm was abused as a child, and we know all of that and the way that the brutality in which he grew up. But outside of them having a couple of tender moments in the bedroom, we haven't seen a tremendous amount of fleshing out those characters' personalities. We like them, but inevitably they seem to be getting the axe here.
Yeah,
perhaps no pun intended there either.
Right. To me, it's similar to the Greyjoy characters. In a show, you just don't have the same amount of time as you would in the books to really flesh out these stories. And some get kind of glossed over a little bit, or like you like to say, yada yada over. So that is one. I mean, if you like those characters, that's great. I think it's a really interesting kind of cute coupling, but yeah, that didn't scream, hey, we're gonna live and go do here after we saw that scene.
There's a cool moment between Tyrion and Jaime where I wish father could be here to see this. And Tyrion says, and Jaime, of course, like, you killed our dad. Like, what are you talking about? And again, it's just that twist the knife one more time, because it would be fun to see for him to see us defending a family he despised so much. It just speaks to the break that Jaime and Tyrion have had from the Lannister bloodline. And it clearly, you know, with the Lannisters pay their debts early on, they were all in all things Lannister. And as they've grown and seen more of the world, they've broken away from that. And Cersei has not, but the two of them have. And that was a cool moment. And again, there's so many of these that remind you in just a line or two how much they've grown. And that was a really nice way to encapsulate just how much Tyrion and Jaime have bucked the trend of the Lannisters being all for them and said, yeah, we're fighting for a greater cause now. And wouldn't it be funny for father to see this, us potentially sacrificing ourselves for a family that isn't ours?
We've known Tyrion's a good person for most of the show. Even in the beginning when he was, you know, whoring around and drinking a lot, you still knew he was a good person, just apt to do things that were not viewed as positive in Westeros. But this was the episode, I think, where you get the final impression that Jaime has switched sides. And I still think there's a little bit of a question about his love for Cersei and what he'll do if Cersei comes back to him and asks him to be with her. That could still be a bit of a contentious point, because he does love her and he says it all the time. But Jaime's always been he's one of the most interesting characters in this show, because he's so on the fence and he always switches sides, and you're always surprised when he's being good or when he's not being good. And to me, this was an episode, and that scene in particular was a great moment of, okay, Jaime he's good now. And it continues on into the scene when everyone else joins Tyrion and Jaime in the room with the fire. It continues into that scene, and you kind of get to this point where you're going, okay, Jaime, You've gotten past whatever it was holding you back. You've gotten past your family name for the most part. And at least in this fight in Winterfell, you're here to help. And I think that's important because there's still a lack of trust for any Lannister, and specifically Jaime, because he loves Cersei. And I think you kind of got a little bit of closure on that, at least in the next episode.
Before we get to the fireside scene, though, we have Gendry giving Arya a special weapon and then giving her his special weapon.
Okay, you got me with that one.
Thank you.
What on earth is the weapon? I remember she handed him the diagram. I don't know what it is.
I've even gone online and looked at it. I'm not 100% sure what it is.
It looks like a harpoon, but like a spear? So I don't really understand what it is. Maybe it's supposed to be reminiscent of the thing she fought with in the Faceless Temple with the other girl, the waif. Maybe it's supposed to be like that in some way, shape, or form, but it looked like it was supposed to have some sort of a propeller on it. And then when he hands it to her, it just looks like a spear. So I don't really know what the weapon is, but I guess we'll find out probably next episode.
Yeah, and I asked, and I made a joke on Twitter at the time that at the very beginning of the episode it said brief nudity. And that can go one of two ways in Game of Thrones. Brief nudity is either boobs or man butt.
Yes.
And every time I see brief nudity, I think, not man butt. And then one of my followers on Twitter is like, no, you'll be ready. It's side boob. I was like, all right, I can like a good healthy side boob. It was Arya's side boob.
Who's
like a little sister.
It also wasn't really just side boob. She turned and you got full right boob.
Just in that moment, I was taking notes throughout the episode. I actually looked up the actress's age because it felt so weird. I'm like, is she 17 or what? She's actually 24 years old.
22, I think.
22, excuse me.
Yeah, Maisie Williams is 22 years old. So it's safe, everybody.
No, but
it's safe.
But it just felt like...
Break out the lotion, I mean.
It felt completely inappropriate,
yeah,
and weird and jarring. Well, and I guess, again, that's a break into how much she's grown and how different she is from when we started this series. But
that's why I said,
man,
that is why they have tried so hard to remind you how young Arya was, because this was the bombshell scene where she goes, I've never had sex before. I'm a virgin. We might die tomorrow. Hey, let's do this, Gendry. And if you have watched the entire show and you've been really, really paying attention, I think part of you wanted Gendry and Arya to get together at some point because there was some sort of weird,
I don't know, man,
primal attraction between the two when they were going up to the wall.
They
originally
felt like brothers and sister to me.
Well, they did.
And then they did it again.
They
Why
did,
do brothers and sisters keep doing it on this show? It felt like they were adopted brother and sister. And
it
then they
did,
do
but
it.
It didn't, right? It did, but it didn't. Because
it did to me.
Gendry was attractive, right? And Arya knew that. And Arya was playing like a boy, but Gendry knew she was a girl the entire time.
That's true.
So I just think there was a little something extra, and I guess if it had to be with anyone, it should have been with Gendry, right?
Yes. No, that part.
What, did you want her to go with, like, sleep
sense
with Podrick or something?
Tyrion.
Because of his legend. so he would have been
Tyrion
with both Sansa and Arya.
Oof.
Not that he ever consummated the Sansa marriage, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, I don't know. It just made me uncomfortable, man. It made me real uncomfortable.
I know. I was sitting there going, oh, Arya's becoming a woman. Oh, Arya's becoming a woman. What is...
And if you're Gendry, I mean, getting it in on your last night is probably a good thing. But in terms of weapon power-inducing moves, Arya, who's always kind of seemed like your little sister, is being like, I've never had sex before. Let's do it before we get murdered by zombies. Not an all-time... I mean, on the boner alert scale, it's real low. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's no way that pickup line was like, yeah.
It was real low, and then it got really high when she goes, what, am I going to take your pants off for you? Let's go. She, like, took control all of a sudden, and then he was like, oh. Yes, ma'am. Yes, okay. Oh, pants off. Okay, let's go.
That's true.
So it kind of switched from, like, boner
zero
level
to 60.
Real quick.
Zero to 60 real quick. Then we get the biggest flex in the history of flexing to get at your lady with Tormund's line about, and again, he is dealing with a different courting system, being from the actual North, being a wildling. He says, I killed a giant at the age of 10. I suckled at the widow's teat for 3 months because she thought I was a baby, and that's why I got so strong, thinking full on that that was the pickup line for Lady Brienne of Tarth. And you just look at Jaime, who's much more traditionalist, and she's clearly doesn't have feelings for both, but there is a love triangle between the three going on there. You look at Jaime, he's like, what is this? I just thought Tormund's line was real flex. I mean, that was a real flex.
I saw a great meme on this after the episode. Tormund goes, you want to know how I got the name Giantsbane? And then it was the literally everybody blank.
Right. Yeah.
And then it was a gif of him just chugging milk cartons or some dude chugging milk cartons. And you're like, oh, God. Ugh. But after that, though, that was a big flex. After that, he did the true flex. When the knighting scene happened and Brienne goes, women can't be knights, he goes, well, that's stupid. F tradition. And that was the real pickup line right there. That was him supporting her 100% and saying, right, you've done more than probably 3/4 of the knights out there. You should be a knight. And that leads us into what was, I think, the defining scene of the entire episode, where, if you'd mind me taking the lead here, where Brienne, Jaime goes, it doesn't need to be a king or a queen to knight someone. A knight can knight someone, and I'll prove it to you. And he goes, Brienne of Tarth, please kneel in front of me. And she looks at him like, are you kidding me? I can't do this. And he goes, would you like to be a knight? And she goes, yeah, absolutely. And one heartfelt moment I think a lot of people missed, or might have missed, was, you know who got Brienne to do it? You know whose look got Brienne to do it?
I think I do.
Podrick.
You're right.
Podrick gave her the slight nod. And Podrick knew the entire time that he was in her service that she wanted to be a knight. And if you remember, throughout all the seasons when he's with her, when they're trying to save Sansa or save Arya or find them or whatever the case was at that point in time in the world, he's doing all the things you would do as a squire to a knight. And she said, I'm not a knight. Stop this. Don't untie my armor. Don't do this. Don't do that. But he knew all along, and it was him who got her to actually go get knighted by Jaime, which I think was, if you didn't get the misty eyes on that scene, you did not have enough of a connection to these characters.
In the name of the warrior, I charge you to be brave. In the name of the father, I charge you to be just. In the name of the mother, I charge you to defend the innocent. Arise, Brienne of Tarth, a knight of the Seven Kingdoms. It gives me goosebumps to say it. I think this whole episode, and we can slide right into kind of takeaways from the episode, the fantasy genre is always, or very often, heavy-handed. You know, you have Jedi, and then, you know, the what do they call it? I'm not a big Star Wars guy. You have
the Sith?
Yeah, the Sith fan. And then you've got Harry Potter, and you've got Lord Voldemort, and then Dumbledore on the other side. In Lord of the Rings, you have these hobbits, and so often it can be heavy.
Game of Thrones, you have dragons and dead people walking.
The Walking Dead, you literally have zombies versus humans. It can be so heavy-handed, and I thought this episode was beautifully done in the sense that we got all these connections again, and we do have one more scene to talk about, but up to this point, so often these things can be heavy-handed, and there was such a subtlety to remind us how much we care about each of these characters and how complex each of these characters are. I think we've discussed that with Arya today, with Jaime, with Brienne.
With Tyrion.
All the things they've been through are so layered. Theon and Sansa, they aren't just good or evil. And yes, there's an overriding good and evil, the living and the dead. But what makes Game of Thrones so special, you know, we joke about boobs and dragons, is actually that there's so much complexity to these characters and the stories, whether it be the books or the show, they're so richly told. And you're taken on a journey with each character. And this show reminded me, I finished this episode knowing that the next show is the big battle. And I went, oh man, I do not want to see the next episode. And at the same time, I cannot wait. That was the point of this. This was to set you up for, remember, nudge, nudge, you love these characters. And I thought that was beautifully done without hitting us over the head with it. I didn't go, oh my God, another heartfelt scene. I went, oh yeah, I love Tormund. He's hilarious. Right. And also, in his own way, deeply, deeply charming. Jaime's been on such a journey from bad to good. I mean, we start with Jaime as someone who sleeps with his sister and pushes a little boy out the window. In every way in the fantasy genre, that character is then irredeemable. He is the ultimate big bad. He wasn't. He's grown and changed. He loses his hand. That his defining characteristic, other than his good looks, is his sword fighting ability. He loses that.
He loses his hand for doing what? Stopping Brienne from getting raped.
Right.
Which was something he never would have done.
He gave up what made him him, his defining characteristic.
Not that he knew that was going
to
happen.
Help him, to help a character that hit season one, episode one character of him would have said, oh, a freak and a beast. And he saves her. And then we come, you know, all the way around where he loves her. And it's an unspoken love. It's an unacted upon love in some ways. And then he knights her and she becomes Ser Brienne of Tarth. And that's maybe as far as their love will ever go. And yet it's as deep and as meaningful a love as I think you'll find anywhere in the show. And again, even that love, and in fantasy, it's so often guy meets girl, fall in love. This is so layered. And I think that's what makes Game of Thrones at times, and it's silly to say in a way, but it makes Game of Thrones beautiful and it makes it different than anything we've ever seen before. And that's why the audience loves it so much.
A lot of the pairings in the show were great, but I do kind of agree with that. And I think I would say that this is the best pairing. They're not a couple, although Brienne probably wants to be one somewhere deep down. But the stuff that they've been through together and the amount of times that they've kind of crossed paths after separating for a while, and yet every time they cross paths, they both still support each other. There have been so many times where they meet and Brienne expects Jaime to still be mean to her. It happened in this episode when Jaime asks to serve under her command in the Battle of Winterfell, which is likely coming next episode. She goes, why aren't you being mean to me? You've never been like this. And every single time they pair together, there's a little moment. And then this was kind of just the cherry on top. This gave us a lot of closure. And I think that's key to just kind of go over your whole point is a lot of times in the fantasy genre, and sometimes it's intentional, you don't get closure with characters and you don't get closure with relationships. And what this is doing, it's almost turning it on its head. It's giving you closure before likely ripping our hearts out and stomping them all over the ground by saying, you now have a conclusion to this relationship. Now who's going to die?
Right.
So I think it's important because if you kill these characters without any sort of closure, you just go, well, what a waste of, like, I don't, come on. Did Brienne really need to die? And now you're like, okay, Brienne's a knight. She got what she always truly wanted. She got it from a person that she does love in some way, shape, or form. When or if she dies, it'll be a little bit easier to stomach, but also that much harder because you got that closure.
The show was about an expansive universe for the first four or five seasons, and now everything's shrinking, and now all these characters are merging and coming back together. And it would have been so easy for this episode to be heavy-handed and clumsy, where you're forcing... And I thought season, you know, the episode one flirted with being kind of on the edge of this. We're like a few too many side glances, a few too many forced connections. I thought this episode was a masterstroke in storytelling in that these characters all reconnected in a very meaningful, unforced way. I mean, Gendry and Arya, that made sense. Tyrion asking Jaime in what is a touching scene. He goes to his brother and says, is there even really a baby? Because you can see his whole world's crippled or, you know, crumbled where he's like, I'm not as smart as I think I am. He goes to his brother and that's unreal in some ways. It seems unbelievable that he would do that. And yet it totally fit because these characters are complex and there is deep rooted relationships. There are deep rooted relationships.
And we've seen that in the past too, where when Tyrion was in the dungeons, Jaime A, broke him out, but B, went to him and talked to him in those moments. Now, it was never necessarily about advice, but those two always had some sort of a bond.
Right.
And that was, again, on the path of Jaime from being bad to good, is his first moment of being good was with Tyrion, because everyone in the Lannister family hated Tyrion, except for Jaime. And it always is mentioned throughout the show. Cersei goes, you always loved that little whatever she calls him in that moment. You've always loved him. And it's true. Jaime has always loved him. And I think that, like I said, you get closure, a little bit of closure there. Before you move on to the final scene, one that you skipped that I think was really, really cool.
I know where you're going.
Was Sam giving Jorah the Tarly family sword.
Ah, yes.
That he stole from the Tarlys, his dad now dead. Because Jorah's dad was Commander Mormont in the Night's Watch, and he gave Jon the Mormont Valyrian steel sword and refashioned the head from a bear to a wolf. So Jorah has come back. He's, I guess, in the best way possible, redeemed himself, because remember, he was exiled from...
For being a slave trader.
Yeah, I think that's what it was, yeah. And he's basically redeemed himself. His dad's not around to see it. Sam is. Sam can't wield the sword. And he goes, I know what you've done, Jorah. I've seen the changes in you, even from afar. I've heard about them, too. Obviously, he wasn't with Jorah for majority of the time. But here, you are a good fighter. You need a sword that will kill them. Here is my family sword. I thought that was a really touching moment as well. Right. Because I don't know about you. I love Jorah. I think Jorah is a great character. Maybe some people think he's boring because he's so stoic. But I think Jorah is such an interesting character because of his relationship with Daenerys and because of how he's also changed from being bad to good in a different way, that I thought it was really cool to kind of see him get that sword and a better weapon and a chance to fight.
Well, we've talked about Brienne and Jaime and Arya and Sansa, and we will get to Jon and Daenerys here. But I think what makes this story so special are these little characters. It's Jorah. It's the Onion Knight giving soup to the girl with the blemish on her face, and she says, I want to fight. And that reminds him of Stannis' daughter, who he loved. And you're reminded that this Onion Knight, who started off with half his fingers cut off, stumps for fingers, and he's this old man, and he blindly seems to follow Stannis no matter what, because he is just always. And then we've seen his development as the Onion Knight into this really deep grandfatherly character.
That's a good comparison for Jorah. I would rate Jorah, if I was doing a power rankings of characters, I'd rank Jorah higher than Davos.
But what I'm saying is those are characters that aren't in the immediate families.
Yes.
Those are characters that are very much, in air quotes, as much as Game of Thrones characters can be, side characters who we've gotten to know. And we care about them. You'd like Ser Jorah to live. I'd really like the Onion Knight to live. I really liked him. He's one of the characters that I kind of ride for. And you see pockets of that on social media now as you share that experience with people on social media. There are huge Sansa fans. There are huge Arya fans. There are Jon fans and Dany fans. There are Cersei fans. There are fans,
there are Night King fans.
Sook wants the Night King to win.
Yeah.
I think a story is beautifully told when there's that many different pockets of fandom within a story. And again, we get two little moments that we kind of left out, and it's somewhat fitting we left them out originally because they are side characters that it's like, oh yeah, those were great moments. And that's what made, I think, this episode special. And then we get everything from here on out is then almost a preview of the next episode. It's Dany and Jon talking, and Jon finally tells Dany that he's learned who his parents are. And I think you had just a great take on this. It didn't necessarily go the way I thought. It didn't go the way you thought either.
No. So I expected a little bit of an OS moment for Daenerys, that I fell in love with my nephew, right? Instead, although I guess I probably should have expected this, she doubts it at first. And I think the great line is, so your brother and your best friend told you. It's totally true, right? It's like, how am I supposed to trust this if it's coming from two of your closest people? But who do I know? And then she goes, so if that's true, you are the rightful heir to the Iron Throne. And she's pissed. She has no semblance of remorse for the relationship. She has no inkling of an idea of, oh my God, I'm in love with this person. Her only reaction is, that's my throne. That is what I have worked for my entire life since my brother was killed. That is mine. And you're saying that you are the rightful heir to that throne. And then the horn blows. So you don't get to, that's where you don't necessarily get closure. That's the one thing in this episode we did not get closure for, was you saw Dany was pissed, and then the horn blows and they have to rush up to the wall to go see what's coming. I was not expecting that reaction at all. Maybe I should have, but based on their relationship, I was expecting a little bit more of a emotional reaction.
Yeah. And Dany said early in this show that every time a Targaryen is born, God flips a coin. And we know she had one good brother and one bad brother, and she's the third. And we don't know which way that coin landed. And I think this is a reminder to the audience, with the way she reacted, that we still aren't 100% sure, especially with the journeys we've seen some of these characters go on, from good to bad, from bad to good, that she could grow mad with power here. This could be a moment for her.
We've seen this moments of be, this. Yeah.
We've seen flashes, and she's always gotten to the edge. And then she burned Sam Tarly's father, and okay, fine, but also his brother. And Tyrion questioned that. And a lot of characters kind of have questioned that. Did she really need to do that? You know, Sam says to Jon, did she need to do that? Would you have done that? And I think she's always kind of been on the fence, even as much as we've rooted for her. She's been on the fence of being the Mad Queen and also maybe the most just queen we've seen in Westeros. Certainly the most just queen we've seen in Westeros, but one of the more just rulers we've seen in Westeros. And there's a fine line there. And we've been reminded so many times that there is a fine line between good and evil in this world. And she's walking a tightrope right now, and we don't really know which way it's going to go and which way that coin really fell. It could come out in this battle, whether she's the Mad Queen or whether she's the Just Queen, the Mother of Dragons.
Did you think it was the right time to tell her? Because I've seen on social media a bit of a backlash as to Jon telling her then. Because to me, Sam told Jon the truth. There is no right time, right? And I don't think Jon expected the horn to blow right after he told her, right? Like, you're like, you have a day to fight this battle.
The audience got to see that the horn blew right after. Jon wasn't going, okay, they're emerging from the forest. Danny, real
tell
quick.
Tell her now.
Hold up. P.S.
Right. So I don't think it was a bad... I think any time is a bad
time. It was their first
time.
Moment alone.
I think any time is a bad time to tell her that, right?
Right. You've been sleeping with your nephew.
Yes.
And,
so,
and by the way, it's actually my throne.
Yeah. So it's any time's a bad time. I didn't think it was that wrong for Jon to do it then.
I don't either, and it fits Jon. And this, you know, to me, a lot of characters have been burned by doing the right thing for honor. I mean, and we're beat over the head with that with Ned Stark in season one, and it's been a layer throughout. Jon has done the right thing a number of times and survived by pure luck and
magic.
And he tells Cersei, I'm already bound to Daenerys. I'm on her side in the war. And Cersei originally backs out of the meeting and says, okay, well, then there's nothing more to discuss. He said, you know, sometimes I'd wish you'd lie. Sometimes Tyrion said, sometimes I wish you'd learn to lie a little bit. Jon still hasn't totally learned that lesson. He could have tried to wait until after the battle, because if Dany dies, if he dies in the end, it wouldn't matter. So maybe wait until the dust is settled before you kick crap up. But that's not who Jon is. And he tells her when he can, because he's an honor-bound character. So far, all the honor-bound characters have gotten kicked in the gut, had their throat slit, had their heads cut off.
Yep.
It'll be interesting to see if that then becomes his downfall, is being honor-bound to tell Daenerys really before he has to, in air quotes there.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think if he had told her later, it might have been worse, because if they win the battle and she's riding high and then he goes, by the way, it's my throne. By the way, it's not yours. So I'm just going to go ahead and yoink this away from you here.
I think he should have told her after the battle, mid-orgasm.
I'm the rightful heir.
I'm your nephew. We've looked it up. It's been confirmed by two people. Don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, that would have been something.
Let's hope this seed doesn't take. Hey-o. Yeah, I'm gonna say that was not the... You know what? That is the right time. That's the right time. I mean, there is no right time, right? He needs
That's
to just
what Sam said, right?
Tell her whenever. He needs to just tell her whenever. Definitely not mid-sex. Winners and losers.
Wait.
Oh, you got one more.
The final shot of the show is huge.
Oh, yeah. I thought we were going to do winners and losers of this episode and then dissect what we think for next
okay.
episode.
All right, let's do
that's
that.
That's why I was doing it that way. That's my fault,
let's
though.
Let's do that. And I have 2 points.
Well, wait, actually, you're right. We have to do it this way because it ties into my winners and losers. So
okay.
Go ahead. I'll let you do the last scene here.
The shot, it fades behind the White Walkers. You see Winterfell in the distance. And the episode goes to black, right? It's very quick. You hear the horn. They all go up. They see that the snow is coming. The storm is coming. And they cut behind the White Walkers, and there they are, and it goes to black. But it is very key, and I'm sure most people have seen this at this point, maybe, if you were paying close attention. The Night King is not there. It is just the generals. Every single White Walker has the long hair. That is everyone that is on the horses that is there. You also don't see the army. You assume it's there because the blizzard is coming, or the avalanche, or whatever you want to call it. But all you see is a line of horses and the generals. The Night King is not there. And that is massive. That has been predicted that maybe the White Walkers were going to King's Landing. Obviously, that's not completely true because they are at Winterfell. It was Winterfell that they were looking at. But the Night King is not there. And nor do you see the dragon. So that is kind of a big deal.
It's potentially a huge deal. I don't know, other than getting into predicting next week's show, I don't know that we can go anywhere with that. Just where was he? Is he hiding because he figured out that they figured out that killing him might mean killing thousands upon thousands of Walking Dead right away?
Is he going after Bran immediately with before the battle starts?
Is he going to taking an army to King's Landing? Right. Does he know he can take King's Landing with one dragon? Daenerys heavily implied that in her battle strategy. We're not just going to do that, but Tyrion says you could take King's Landing with a dragon or two in, I think he says like in an hour or something. Yeah. He says like in a day or whatever. He just says it would be really easy. So does the Night King know that as well? All stuff to discuss here coming up, but winners and losers from season 8, episode 2.
Winner first. Winner is Brienne to me. That was a great moment for Brienne. Interesting enough, personally, I have not been a huge Brienne fan. I think although her character has a lot of depth and she gets into interesting situations, the fact that she's so driven by her honor sometimes is a little bit boring. I love the characters in this show that are so gray. I love Littlefinger. I love Tyrion. I love Varys. Who, by the way, he's there, but what's Varys going to do, right? Like, Varys seems to have disappeared from the face of the earth in terms of the show. He's counseling, but I love Jaime. I love those characters for their depth and the potential that they could change. Brienne has never had that potential, so I've always found her a little bit boring in that sense. I thought it was such a great moment when, A, Jaime goes and asks to fight under her, and then when she gets knighted, it was a realization of everything she had worked for had worked out on what is potentially the last day of her life. And she is now Ser Brienne of Tarth. And that's cool. So I thought she was the winner.
Yeah, my winner ties directly into yours. Mine is Jaime. And for a lot of the reasons you just said, we've always known what Brienne would be, right? I mean, she's always been honor bound to hopefully be accepted and someday be a knight, knowing probably it'll never happen. But she takes these little steps and gains respect all along the way. But she's a pretty linear character. Jaime is not. And Jaime's storyline from big bad to maybe big good has been woven through Brienne and her always right straight course. And I thought Brienne was always going to want to be knighted. And that fit her. She didn't grow in this episode. Jaime did. Jaime could have easily not stepped up in that moment and knighted her, and he did. And Jaime took himself to the Starks and said, you know, Cersei's not coming. He didn't have to do that. He knew full well they could have seen him and killed him, and he didn't, because it was the right thing. He reconnected with Tyrion. I thought the winner was Jaime, and I totally agree that on paper the winner is Brienne, because her linear storyline has finally been realized, maybe the day before she dies, probably the day before she dies or the night she dies.
She is leading the left flank. I mean,
right.
Chances are she's not going to make it.
That's a win.
Yeah.
That's a win for her. She wins. But I think Jaime stepping up emotionally shows his growth and development. And because of that, I think Jaime is the winner of the episode. But again, those characters, as befits both of them, those winners are always going to be woven together.
And Brienne is a major reason why Jaime has changed to good, too, because of what you just said there. She's been so bound by loyalty and honor, and when Jaime's been with her, he's seen that. And even though he's not, or in some cases is, but he's not completely, that has kind of rubbed off on him a little bit, too.
I think there are mini wins here. Do you want to go over some mini wins?
Sure.
I think Theon gets a mini win. He came back, and the family that he helped destroy has accepted him to protect Bran, who they think is a really valuable chess piece in this whole thing.
True.
He's earned back some, some respect from that family. I think that's massive. Arya and Gendry. Arya has this secret weapon. We don't totally know what it is. That could be a big win for her. Also, she got it in. She lost her virginity. And Gendry got to be with Arya. And
he's a weird character, isn't he?
He is.
He feels like he just reappeared to reappear this season or last season, where he was gone for like three straight seasons after they got rid of him. Not got rid of him, but he stayed in King's Landing. It kind of felt like it was a, let's bring this guy back for convenience, but I'm happy that it happened.
Gendry's a bastard, right? I mean, he's Robert Baratheon's bastard son. So if anyone was going to take him in and respect him and treat him well, it would be the Stark family.
Yep.
And he's very much connected to a woman who could end this thing with quite a bit of power. And also, he liked her. And all along the show, one of the sweet moments in this show one of the sweeter moments is in the show and the relationships in the show has been the two of them. And so for them to reconnect kind of as adults and be together is I think a mini win for both characters.
I think Jorah got a mini win as well. A, right. Getting a sword, but B, proving to himself that he has the ear of Daenerys back and the trust of Daenerys back, because he was able to convince her to stick with Tyrion, and then he got the sword. So a little mini win for Jorah too.
There you go. I agree.
Losers?
Losers. Go ahead.
I mean, it's kind of easy for me. It's Daenerys. This episode, Daenerys finds out she's not the rightful heir to the Iron Throne. Daenerys finds out she's been sleeping with her nephew. Daenerys gets trodden over by her council when Jaime's there. She wants to kill Jaime or chain him up, and they tell her otherwise. She kind of loses the Sansa scene where she's trying to win her over, and she kind of loses it at the end and then gets interrupted, so she can't actually answer that question. And by the way, the battle's here. So to me, I feel like Daenerys is the loser of this episode.
Mine are sneaky, and you're right. Daenerys is definitely on the loser list this episode. Mine is Cersei. I think we've always just thought the entire army would attack Winterfell. Now it very much seems to be in play. It's possible the Night King has taken a dragon to King's Landing.
Yep, or even some of the army too.
And she is not prepared.
No.
She's nowhere near prepared for that. She thinks she's hanging out in the summer waiting for her enemies to fall. And instead, she may find herself ill-prepared for a battle she can't win, Cersei, and who knows? I mean, Cersei might not be a loser. They might be there and they're waiting and they're the second wave. You know, the Night King is the second wave with the dragon. But this, to me, feels like Cersei's in some trouble. And then anyone who thinks it's a good idea to hide in the crypt, if we've learned anything, it's that people are coming back to life who are not burned and are attacking people. So it seems to me the crypt would not be a super safe place to be when the dead are coming back to life and attacking people.
And guess who's going to be in the crypt? Tyrion.
Good. Yeah.
Tyrion's going to be in the crypt. Remember, Daenerys sent him there. Yes. Says, I need your mind. So we're going to see dead Ned Stark come back and attack the Starks. How about that? If that's actually true.
It's going to be wild, I think.
That's my thought is, really, you're going to put them in the crypt? That was your great idea. I know it's probably the safest underground place, but that's where the dead people are.
Just burn them.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Burn them. Save yourselves.
Just burn them.
You can keep their statues. Just burn them, please. One other thought I had, too, with Bran is, how does he know for sure the Night King is trying to kill him? How does he know for sure that the Night King's plan is to erase the memories of the old world and change it to the Night King's world by killing Bran? I know that he went after and killed the previous Three-Eyed Raven. But how do we know that's the reasoning behind it? And how do we know that Bran going to the Godswood is going to be actual bait?
We don't. That felt, again, you always tease me about talking about yada yada moments. That felt like a real yada yada. We're missing a vision somewhere with Bran. There needed to be a 3-minute vision where the Night King is points to the Godwoods and then like points to a wheelchair with a guy pushing it, jumping out of a closet and being like, this group. Because there is no way, you know, again, it's kind of yada yada. We assume Bran knows because Bran is all knowing. And yet that seems like a leap potentially to make in terms of battle strategy here. It just seems like they want to get as far south as they can by taking over the world. It doesn't necessarily seem to me that it's like, we got to get this wheelchair kid. You know, I mean, there needed to be a vision that he had somewhere in any season.
Or intentionally, they didn't have the vision because he is wrong.
Right.
Because Bran is still new to being the Three-Eyed Raven. And the old Three-Eyed Raven said to him, you're not ready, but it needs to be now.
Right.
So he just might not be fully prepared to make these kind of predictions. Yes, he can see the past. Yes, he can see what's happening currently by using animals. But maybe he's not fully ready to be all-knowing in the fact where he can make strategies to help in the future. Because that's the one thing we know is Bran cannot see the future. But he can use all the knowledge he has to predict the future. Maybe he hasn't gotten that down yet.
Next week episode, I'm not ready emotionally.
Nope.
It's going to be rough. We're going to tape it the next morning. I may not sleep. It may be brutal.
Yeah, there's going to be that. This episode was the, hey, everyone's going to die next episode, so enjoy it while you can. It's the last, I saw this post and I thought it was great. This is the last happy episode. Episodes 3, 4, 5, and 6 of this season likely will not be happy.
Maybe the last half of 6. Please.
Maybe. Please. They did. Someone did say, I think it was Amelia Clark said bittersweet. So maybe there's a little something going on there at the end that'll be a little bit nice. But this was the last good episode, the last positive episode. We're going to see a massive battle scene or two next episode.
And it's a whole the whole episode, I believe it's an hour and a half long, and the whole thing is supposed to be a battle scene, and it's the longest, biggest battle scene in the history of TV or movies. There's never been a movie or TV show that's done an hour and a half worth of pure battle.
That might be a little bit overdone. Sometimes, look, I love battle scenes. That might be a little too much, but we'll see if they intermingle the storytelling in there too.
That's what's been
I know.
Said.
I'm not saying the prediction is wrong.
I thought you were saying what I said is overstated. Because that's what everyone has talked about, that this is the longest battle scene in the history of TV or movies.
If the entire episode is a battle, what I'm saying is that might be a little bit too much. They've done it before, so I'm assuming they will. They better drop in little nuggets of story and relationship stuff. Because an entire hour and a half of a battle, although it'll be exciting, at a certain point will be a bit of a, oh my God, it's still going on, right? And so much of what makes the show great is the conversations and the relationships. So I hope that they still intermingle that in with the battle.
Even the Battle of the Bastards, which felt really long and epic, there was other things in the episode first.
Yes, they cut away from it and stuff. Yeah.
So I think you're right. There may need to be something else, just a breather. For us, just like a breather for these characters, because if they're fighting for a day or 2 days or something in this episode, it's going to be rough on all of us.
Yes.
That's it. Season 8, Episode 2.
Yep. It was called A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms. It was a great one. While the first one I thought was good, I didn't love it. This one I loved. I was very, very pleased with this episode, and I am ready and not ready all at the same time to deal with next week.
Next week, the biggest battle in the history of cinema.
Let's do it!
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.